Russ, my wife and I, we were talking this morning on the way back from church about the upcoming election. And I'm frankly really frustrated. Like here in Florida, we have two choices for governor, a Republican and a Democrat. I don't like either of them. And we're starting to wonder now that we're in our, I'm going to be 50 here soon. My wife's a little bit older than me, but we're at that point in our life where we're starting to get cynical and we're starting to think that maybe all these elections are really rigged. And where I probably got this idea from in recent months is now the talk is that the next election is likely to be Hillary Clinton up against Jeb Bush. And I thought to myself, really? With all the people that live in this country, we're back to a Bush versus a Clinton. Let me start by asking you, as an investigative reporter, as a guy that's looked into the secret history of the government, what are your thoughts about how legitimate these elections are? I mean, maybe the elections themselves are legitimate, but that we don't get to choose really who's on the ticket anymore. It seems like it's sort of decided that one of these two people that the elite want are our only two choices.
Well, let me answer that, if I may, in a slightly roundabout way. And first of all, I want to apologize for my voice. A magazine interviewed me the other day, and he was doing a profile of me, and I said, by the way, I don't usually sound like this. And he said, oh, because I think he was going to describe me as this gravelly-voiced guy. But
you're like the new Alex Jones, right, of investigative reporting?
Yeah, exactly.
But just don't tell us you have Ebola. That's all we need to know.
I hope not. I think it's a throat infection. But in any case, and obviously laryngitis. I was thinking about this very subject today because when Family of Secrets came out, it's already about, I think it's 5 years ago, and it's many people are just discovering it for the first time. It's actually selling about as briskly now as it was early on. And I had posited that there was a lot about the process of electing presidents and about why we don't see the kinds of changes you would expect when it shifts from one party to the other. And at the time, some people said, well, you know, you write well, and this is all documented and footnoted, but it sounds a little bit crazy. And do you know that I don't hear that much anymore? And in fact, there's a new book out. It's from an academic. I don't think it's going to get a huge amount of attention, but he's a professor, I think at Tufts or something, and his book is, he calls it, my book, the subtitle is the Secret History and, you know, the Hidden Government and so forth, and he uses the term double government. And in his book, he says, you know, in the reviews in the Boston Globe, they all rush to say he's not one of those nutty conspiracy theorists. And then they go on to posit his conspiracy, which is basically that the way things work is that the government is essentially this sort of permanent apparatus. It's essentially the military and the State Department and so on, and all these bureaucrats who are there sort of long term. They stay on and on and on, and they have these networks of friends and associates and so on, and that they're really kind of shaping the policy, and these presidents come and go and really just frankly can't do a lot to kind of move this thing in any direction. Now, that's a somewhat different interpretation than mine, because I look a lot more at outside players, meaning the very wealthy in this country, corporations and associations and networks among them, and their relationships then to this bureaucracy, and I see the bureaucracy as more working for those outside interests. But in any case, what I find interesting is that people like professors at major universities are beginning to write books that acknowledge what you just said, which is the real limitations and constraints that I think begin to explain why you go from a Bush to an Obama, and it's the same defense secretary. You know, why is that? I mean, I don't even remember the media asking, what was Robert Gates staying on for, you know? Any of these things, was so many similar people, the people who cycle in and out.
And that's a great point that you make, Russ, because of all things that Obama said he was going to do, he was going to change the military policy, you know, get us out of all these wars and so forth, and then to keep the same defense secretary, was really quite remarkable, which is why many people have referred to Obama as Bush 2, because many of the things that he's doing now are right in line with what George Bush did. In your book, and I have a slight disability. I'm blind in one eye, so I can't read as many pages in a day as, you know, typically most people can. So I haven't read the entire book, so forgive me if this is in the book, but do you get into at all the issue of Jeb Bush and this whole notion that he is going to be at least the Republican nominee this next presidential cycle? The idea that this whole Bush mystique, whatever it is, does that travel down as far as Jed?
Well, I'll, a couple of things. First of all, I just want to mention for you and anybody else who may have problems either with reading or just don't have the time, if you drive much, Family of Secrets is available as an audio book, and I'm hearing more and more people
going
that route. Oh,
I'll get that. That's for sure. Yeah. I need to do that tomorrow.
Yeah.
Very good.
So that's one thing. Now, when Family of Secrets came out, the notion of another Bush in the White House really was not on the horizon. There is quite a bit in the book explaining about the kind of permanency of the Bush construct and what that family is really about. And what I do is I go way back a whole bunch of generations to how this family were sort of presenting themselves as essentially sort of operatives of richer, more powerful people and families and interests, that they've sort of set themselves up that way. And so I think by reading all that back history, you can understand that this is really is a dynasty that they're in play for. The
Russ, I almost love your subtitle more than your title.
Yeah, I know.
I love,
you know,
that subtitle.
That wasn't even the original subtitle. Something about doing books, you have to deal with these book publishing companies and they have their own ideas. And so the original subtitle was something like The Powerful Forces That Blah, Blah, Blah. But it was different and it wasn't quite as juicy. So I like it better.
Yeah. Now, one of the themes of the whole book, at least I've gotten this part of it so far, is that there are these networks that exist between the elite, these people who we can go back over 100 years, these families of wealth and power and so forth and so on. And I wanted to have you get into that, but I wanted to set that up with kind of a current news story. So the President Obama, is facing all of this criticism about what's going on with Ebola and all of these protocols that aren't being followed and so forth. So he decides he's going to bring in someone he's calling an Ebola czar. And so everybody was wondering, you know, who is this going to be? Is it going to be, you know, Sanjay Gupta, the doctor from CNN, who I guess was up for a surgeon general at one point, or just some famous doctor, someone with experience with pandemics or whatnot. He ends up bringing in someone by the name of Ron Klain. And I don't know if you're familiar with the story because it just came out, but everybody said, who's Ron Klain? And it turns out that this guy has absolutely no medical background at all. And the White House said that he was hired for his experience in management and also his contacts throughout the government. And he has no medical background at all. Even liberals are outraged about this selection. But does that not make a point that your book really gets into, which is that networking and this whole idea of who you know and these networks seem to be what government is all about? It's almost like, who cares about how qualified you are for the job if you know the right people? And in this case, this guy not only knew the right people, but because he knows a number of people, he got picked for the job because he's a networker.
I'm going to withhold judgment on that. I'll tell you why. These various memes get started, you know, where we all kind of, there's sort of a vacuum and we all conclude something. I am not yet sure whether that's a bad decision. And I do want to talk about these networks of power, but this is a guy, you know, he was Al Gore's chief of staff. He's been in Washington for a long time. One of the things that he was supposed to do always was to basically break heads and get things done. And this is one of the reasons I'm not happy with the media. And again, I'm not in any way necessarily disagreeing with you, but I think that we hear these things that start, you know, getting out there, and this may actually have been a good choice.
Well, you and I, we could agree to disagree on that. I was just surprised that, like we were talking about a moment ago, the idea of here we are looking at another Bush versus Clinton election, and with all the people in the whole United States, that there wasn't somebody outside of Washington that had some great medical background that would be put in this position, at least for public confidence, if for that alone. And then he could have hired this Ron Klain as his chief of staff, whoever this public person was who was sort of the medical guru that we were going to have as the figurehead, which many of these people are many times just figureheads, I'll admit that. But I would have thought somebody would have been put in there that had a medical background. But we move on, and that's fine. So let's talk, though, about these families that have these power structures. And I do find it odd that, for example, it's almost like professional wrestling. We were supposed to believe for all those years that the Bushes and the Clintons were sort of like the Hatfields and the McCoys, and now we see the Bushes and the Clintons hanging out together, all these pictures of them out on boats together and going up to the cabin in Kennebunkport and all this. And it makes you wonder, is this not just all one big family, and this idea of these adversarial plots that seem to develop are all just for show?
Well, you know, I don't think they're for show, but I think it tells us something about the narrowness of the permissible. In other words, you know, you have Clinton running against Bush's father. He beats Bush's father, and then pretty quickly, Clinton and Bush 41 become very close. And you may remember that they even said that I'm trying to remember which one it was of the Bushes said that Bush 41 considered Bill Clinton like his son.
Right, I heard
amazing.
That.
And then,
it
of course,
is.
If that's his son, that I guess would make Jeb Bush his brother-in-law or something. or brother or whatever.
They would be brothers.
Hillary,
that's right. They would
Hillary
be like
would be,
no, political stepbrothers.
Hillary would be running against her brother-in-law. So there you go. Okay. Anyway, it's all very, very odd. And the thing is that these people end up essentially accommodating each other because of the narrowness of their base of support. In other words, when they are all having to kowtow to this, what I call the military-industrial complex, when they all have, you know, to choose from a range of different bankers from the same firms who, you know, may have slightly different approaches. I think there are slightly different approaches from a Democratic to Republican administration. But essentially, letting these guys get off scot-free for, you know, essentially destroying the American economy, continuing in the case of Obama, he said one of the first things he was going to do was shut down Guantanamo. It's still open. And, you know, again, it gets back to that issue of the limitations. And so these people are basically chosen by these sort of networks of individuals, of companies, of loyalties. It operates on many, many different levels. And when we look at the Bush family, it really is the network writ large, because if you go all the way back, you'll find that W's grandfather's grandfather, I want to say maybe even great-grandfather, was a from an affluent family, and back in those days, one of your children would be a lawyer, and one might be a professor, and one would be a pastor. And so he was a pastor, but what kind of pastor was he? He worked with the Navy, and he also ministered to some of the wealthiest congregations in New York. We believe he was actually involved in intelligence work around the time of the Civil War. You know, these kinds of linkages have always existed, and then the children are born into it. A guy like Clinton, from a relatively poor background, not from those kinds of networks, but very quickly understands what he needs to do to be successful. And so that's really, I think, what you see. A guy like Obama, the same thing, from a very modest background, but very quickly understood that these Ivy League schools, that he had to go on a certain path. And then at the same time, he needed to do those little things that the press makes so much about, like, you know, that he was a community organizer.
Russ, I was doing my homework on this today, and I thought I'll go all the way back to Prescott Bush, who was born in 1895. But then I found out some information about Samuel Prescott Bush, who was the father of Prescott Bush, who apparently was a steel company president and also was a federal official in the U.S. government in charge of the coordination and assistance involving weapons contracts in the government. And I'm thinking to myself, how far does this go back? I mean, it's like, and they all go to Yale. They're all skull and bones. Yeah. They're all sent off at high school age to these prep schools. And when you start looking into this history, I don't want to sound weird, but it almost gives me chills. Like, this is just weird that everybody's got all these same connections. I mean, even in my own family, you know, we're all mostly from Chicago. We all mostly like Italian food, but that's where it stops. I mean, that's it. I mean, these people are like robots coming off the assembly line.
And they know who all their forebears are. I mean, I can barely tell you who my great grandfathers were, but they know all these guys. And then you got Prescott and his dad Samuel and his dad Reverend James Bush, I was telling you about, and his dad. I can go back even further. They've got a guy who, as far as I can tell, may have been in some sort of a real estate speculation group that loosely involved George Washington.
Wow.
He's got another ancestor who was a captain of a ship that was made to walk the plank by pirates. And I believe another ancestor who, believe it or not, was burned at the stake as a witch.
Wow. Who knew? And here we. So that's our little nugget for the Halloween season, right there, folks.
Right.
That it
right.
all started back maybe in Salem, Massachusetts. We're going to open up the phone lines now. 877-317-6432. Your questions for Russ Baker on his book, or really anything you want to talk about. He covers all the current events, and he's got a really good, interesting take on things. 877-317-6432, or as we always do, since most of our listeners on Sunday nights are listening over the internet, you can send your question by email, jim@christianmoney.com, jim@christianmoney.com, or again, the phone lines are open, 877-317-6432. Russ, talk about the Skull and Bones deal. Is that more of a legend than it really played in terms of a significant part in this whole Bush story? Because we always hear about Yale. We always hear about the Skull and Bones.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. And also I want to remind you about something you brought up, which is the Bin Laden relationship. And I would love to get into that later as well.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Okay, Skull and Bones. So, you know, a lot of people sort of poo-poo that, and they say, oh, well, who cares about that? What are you going to make a big deal about that? And my answer is, you know what, I'm not making a big deal about it. They're making a big deal about it because they join these things. They're very, very sort of devout, if you will, in their loyalty to it, and they stay involved after they leave Yale. And these things are considered to be tremendously important. Those sorts of organizations, Skull and Bones, and there are many others at Ivy League schools particularly, but also at other places, these are all cohesion instruments. They are ways of bringing people together, forming bonds, and loyalties, trust, the ability to share and keep secrets. And of course, all of this is tremendously important in the intelligence services, into which many of them entered. And so these kinds of things actually need to be studied. We have, you know, Skull and Bones only has 14 members per year. It's a very, very limited group. George W. Bush was in there. Prescott Bush, was in there. And George H.W. in between was in there as well. And so obviously the Bush family is considered to be important to that group, and they consider it to be important to them.
And most people forget about that George Bush 41, the father. We got to keep all these Bushes. We got to be like Jesse Jackson, stay out the bushes, right? But we've got to keep these all these players straight. So George Bush, the father, the 41st president, many people forget about his CIA background, and then also this bizarre thing that you get into in your book where he may have been in Dallas on the day that JFK was assassinated, but doesn't publicly seem to remember where he was that day. Tell us a little bit about the connections to the CIA and how that might all connect to the that fateful day in Dallas in 1963.
Sure. Well, my work for Family of Secrets, I just started trying to understand what George W. Bush's presidency meant for America. And the more I studied him, the more I saw that you couldn't really understand his improbable rise without understanding the father. I then began with the father, 41, trying to understand his rise, which also turns out to have been very improbable. And the more I studied the more I saw that I needed to go back and look at his having been director of the CIA. I found that to be improbable because he had no apparent qualifications to be a CIA director. They said he had never been in intelligence and knew nothing about it, and I said, well, why would you put him in there? And then I began studying that, and what I discovered was that George H.W. Bush 41 had a secret life. And a good part of my book, Family of Secrets, is about H.W.'s secret life, that in fact he was qualified to be CIA director because he had been secretly in the CIA for many, many years, even decades, prior to being officially made the head of it, and this explains quite a lot, actually. And so we go back, and I discover that in 1963, he was in the CIA. He was actually in the CIA all the way back in the 50s. And in 1963, his cover was his oil company, his drilling company, Zapata Offshore. And when I learned, as you pointed out, that he had claimed not to remember where he was when Kennedy was shot, knowing already that he had had this secret life, I thought, guy's in Texas. He's in intelligence work. He's already 40 years old. Part of his cover, he's running for the U.S. Senate that year. Kennedy comes to Texas. How could he not remember? And so I decided to try to figure out where he was. And that took me on a kind of a side trip of several years where I became interested in the Kennedy assassination. And so Family of Secrets actually has five chapters of new information I unearthed about the Kennedy assassination, something that I really didn't know a whole lot about, but it really gets into the CIA's fury with John F. Kennedy, H.W. Bush and his father, Prescott Bush's close relationships with Alan Dulles, who JFK fired over the Bay of Pigs thing. And we go deeper and deeper, and we start finding out the relationships from all of these people to these networks of power, of bankers and oil companies and what have you, and the extent to which they help determine who becomes president, and as far as my research suggests, who stops becoming president.
Yeah, fascinating information, and the emails are pouring in. We don't have any callers yet, but there's a very long email coming in from one of our listeners in Chicago, and I'm just going to hit on some of the high points here. This is they're asking about Osama bin Laden. They're asking about the Bush family's connection to the bin Laden family. Did they help the bin Laden family get out of the U.S.? They're asking about the Bush's family after 9/11, their connection, and all of the money that George Bush, the father, has made from speaking engagements, etc., from Middle Eastern countries. What say you, Russ Baker, about all of these bizarre connections?
The most interesting thing for me, which I chronicle in Chapter 13 of Family of Secrets, which is all about H.W., his nickname in the family is Poppy, and I use that in the book, just Poppy and W, because it's easier, instead of saying George and George all the time. And so this gets into how in 1976, shortly after Poppy Bush becomes CIA director...
And Russ, get back into this bin Laden thing. I'm fascinated, the connection between the Bush family, Osama bin Laden, and then his whole family, the bin Ladens, and the Middle East connection and all the money that the Bushes have made since the Iraq War. Go back into that.
So in 1976, shortly after Poppy Bush takes over the CIA, a young fellow by the name of Jim Bath, who was a friend of his son and who knew him well, gets this call. And next thing you know, he is set up in business as the representative in the United States of two of the most important families in Saudi Arabia. One is the Mahfouz family, which owns the biggest bank in the kingdom. The other is the largest a construction and engineering empire in the country, the bin Laden family. And they hire Jim Bath to be their representative, and they begin setting up all of these businesses and companies. To make a long story short, my research suggests that that basically was all engineered by Poppy or George H.W. Bush, and this ties in later with all these things like Iran-Contra and these loops where a lot of the money from Saudi Arabia is going into banks controlled by people in this sort of Bush circle. Everybody's benefiting, and they're all doing very, very well together. And, of course, we see that flash forward to the day of the 9/11 attacks, and there is former President George H.W. Bush involved with the Carlyle Group, again with one of the top bin Laden people involved with that as well. And so they really were very close. The Bush and the bin Laden families were very, very close business partners all the way through. And then you've got to do your own factoring as to whether or not it's true that the bin Laden family disowned the one son and that everything that he did was unbeknownst to them.
And the part of the question here they're asking about after 9/11, that the bin Ladens that were here in the U.S. were rushed out of the country with the help of the Bush family. Is that true?
Well, I mean, right away, even though it was either there were no flights or very few flights at that point, several planes were dispatched and they picked up some of the wealthiest and most connected Saudis in the country were typically young people who were either in college or whatever, and they flew them out of the country. Now, I know that the explanation for that was that with so many Saudis purportedly among the hijackers, that it was going to be dangerous for any Saudi in the United States. But the fact of the matter is all the rest of the Saudis who lived here had to continue living here. It was only the ones from these privileged families or connected to the royal family who were basically just spirited out of the country. And what's also significant about that is that you would think that interviewing them would have been a priority for the FBI, and the fact that they never did that, I think, is notable.
Very bizarre stuff. All right, now this email is coming in from Dallas, and I guess in fairness to set this question up, the question is about any connections between the Bush family, of course, you know, back this would be in the 30s and the 40s, between the Bush family and the Nazis through their banking connections. And in fairness, even if your answer is yes, I think there were a lot of families, a lot of those wealthy families were doing business with Hitler before they knew what a monster he was. Maybe I'm giving them a free pass by saying that, but was there in fact any connections there between the Bush dynasty and Adolf Hitler?
The Bush family were very involved with an investment bank called Brown Brothers Harriman, and that bank being run by Prescott Bush's father-in-law, with Prescott Bush as a partner, was doing business with some of the wealthiest German industrialists and bankers and what have you. Some of those financed the rise of Hitler. I think they probably, in fairness, did not realize how that was going to turn out. They saw him as somebody they thought they could manipulate. And so in any case, they definitely were involved with those people. And so certainly some of that money went to finance Hitler. What happened later on was that when the U.S. was at war with Germany, the Brown Brothers Harriman, through its relationship with something called it's complicated, but anyway, this banking entity that they were fronting for, again, German industrialists backing Hitler, they helped them move their money out of Germany when they needed to. So certainly, it was behavior that was egregious enough that it was investigated by a committee of Congress. Basically the whole thing was shut down and shut up, and it's even, you can find some of it in books and some of it on the internet, but almost nobody's heard about this. And it's just amazing how little discussion there was of what was perceived to be essentially a traitorous role once the war had started.
And the next email is coming in here from Chicago. They're saying they have heard you on another talk show talking about some of your observations about the Warren Commission, and they want you to make some points about your thoughts on the Warren Commission all these years later. Of course, we're coming up on the 51st anniversary of the JFK assassination here in just a matter of weeks.
I mean, I could talk for hours just about the Warren Commission, but very quickly, there's no question, my research shows that the Warren Commission was designed to be a cover-up. And let me say that all of these federal commissions are cover-ups. The 9/11 Commission, the Iran-Contra Commission, they're all cover-ups. The nature of institutions is to cover up bad news, to cover up bungling, to cover up corruption. They're generally not inclined to want to get to the bottom of things, and the Warren Commission was no different. I just got back recently from Washington, where I spent a week in the National Archives, and I actually found documents where members of the Warren Commission staff are explicitly stating that they understand that their purpose is to conclude and to prove that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Now, of course, that's not the purpose of an investigatory commission.
Yeah, that, and there's so many bizarre things about the Warren Commission. Like you said, I mean, you could go on for hours on that. I've written a book on the JFK assassination as well, and it's just tragic that people bought that story at the time. I don't know how many did, but I guess current stats are that a large percentage of the American population has doubts, and I think more doubts are going as these years continue to pass without them releasing all of the documents. Next email is coming in here from California, and they want to know your thoughts on the next generation of Bushes, specifically, and I hear this name so much, George P. Bush. I guess this is a son of Jeb Bush, and he's sort of being groomed to be like the next generation of the Bush dynasty. Is he the name to watch, or are there others?
There are others, believe it or not. They're cousins in the wings and so forth. It's kind of this machine that just keeps cranking out production. But, yeah, I think he's the main one to look at because he's likely to win a post in Texas, which is a very powerful post that deals with oil leases, as you can imagine how significant that is. And he's a very polished guy. His mother is Mexican. The Bush family's masterful about this. They were like a kind of a pioneer family. They sent everybody out, you know, to different territories, you might say.
And Jeb Bush will break into his Spanish here and there as well.
There you go.
Yeah,
and they work every angle.
And that's going to come in handy, at least on this election. That might be his strongest suit. Hey, Russ, next time we're going to have to book you for 2 hours if they'll work that out with your press people. But I really appreciate you coming on, especially with your problem with your voice and all that. You're a real trooper for coming on. You're a fascinating guest, and I want to encourage people to get the book. This is the time of the year. You know, you got some days off for Thanksgiving, Christmas. Grab a book like this and enjoy it. It's so well documented, like 100 pages of footnotes. And also the website, whowhatwhy.com, whowhatwhy.com. Russ Baker, Family of Secrets, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you. It's been enjoyable.